blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Dear listener, you're listening to the Three Wise Men of Podcasting, the pod people. We're coming to bring the new baby Jesus gifts in this year of 2024. I'm Matisse Van Rossum, and I come to new baby Jesus bearing a gift of an anime waifu body pillow. Ganbatte, Jesus-kun.
I'm Ben Sheets. I have one nice, fresh Newport.
Wow. What a nice thing. I think we could all use that in these trying times. Hello, I'm Cleveland Mosier, and I would like to see the baby. And I'm bringing the baby Jesus in this year, 2024. A right-angle drill adapter, 4-in-1 impact drill bit extension, 360 rotatable quarter, 3/8 and half-inch impact grade socket adapter set, 105 degree angle screwdriver drill bit for household workplace industry. That's what I'm bringing him. Because he's a carpenter, you know? Hey. There's all sorts of new tools to get.
Maybe so, they won't use nails next time.
Yeah, maybe.
He was a carpenter, but now in 2024, he's a Twitch streamer.
Oh, God, I hope not.
Yeah, baby Jesus is a Twitch streamer. We just got back. We just got back from seeing Immaculate.
And it was pretty immaculate.
Hey.
For Christ.
yeah.
I am sitting backwards in my chair right now like a youth pastor, just so you guys
are aware. He has his hat turned
Fortnite
to the
Jesus
side.
Christ.
That's right. Yeah, we're going to learn about the cheat codes of God and all the cool stuff.
God could probably Jesus. Do a no-scope.
We're going right. to get rizzed up for Christ.
God damn.
It's the son of God.
Fuck. Yeah, we did predict this movie at the beginning of the year, but we did not have much to go off of at that time. We knew it was a religious horror movie starring Sydney Sweeney as a nun. We've been seeing some trailers for it that have been overlapping with the first Omen trailers, and at least in the trailers, they looked almost identical. A lot of overlap.
I honestly, like, even sitting in the seats, didn't know which was which for this movie. I couldn't have told you.
I think all of us went into this with, I mean, I went into it with no real expectations.
I didn't really want to see it. Doing it for the podcast. Doing it for the pod.
Yeah, I mean, like, my expectations were pretty low. When we were predicting, I looked up this director, and all of his other movies had, like, middling reviews. So
he hasn't done very much.
Well,
I was just...
He did a movie called The Voyeurs.
Like...
Sydney Sweeney and Justice Smith.
In, like, 2021, I haven't seen it.
Yeah,
other than
I haven't
that,
seen it either.
He did some, like, shorts. And I looked up the dude who wrote this, too, and, like, one of his only directing credits was a PUBG short film.
Wow.
Wow.
So, yeah. But, I must say, I thought this movie was kind of awesome. Not for the reasons that I was expecting, though.
I will say, I don't think it was awesome, but it definitely won me over by the end of it.
I had a great time with this movie. It made me smile.
I was going into this movie with low expectations. I had seen Sydney Sweeney in The White Lotus, the HBO show. It's a very good show, but I didn't find Sydney Sweeney to be a very good actress, so I wasn't expecting much. And to be frank, I don't think she's a great actress in this, but I think it works in spite of her.
I thought she did fine. Yeah, I mean, this is the first thing that I've actually seen her in. Like, she's having kind of a big moment right now.
Because of her big moments,
yeah,
you could
well,
say.
Yeah.
What?
Well, I mean, she's...
Her big...
Oh, shut up! So what are you saying, T?
She's one of these... as far as I know, she got famous for Euphoria.
Yes.
Which I still have not seen. Sam Levinson, I do not care about any of his work. Not for me. But she's been having a big moment right now. She had that rom-com come out recently with Glenn Powell.
Which, I guess, I apparently read that it's an adaptation of Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh, really? Okay, weird. Wouldn't have guessed that. I guess I don't know my Shakespeare well enough. But she hosted SNL a few weeks ago, which I didn't see, but that also...
Oh, who watches SNL?
Yeah, anymore, like... yeah. But it did sort of, like, catapult her into the limelight of the online discourse, because, folks, great news. Wokeness, it's dead. And Sydney Sweeney killed it.
Yeah, with her,
With her huge jugs.
I'm so lost.
I mean, what's there not to understand, Cleveland?
Is this a meme?
Sydney Sweeney's big old
it's not,
knockers.
No, it's not. It's
woke.
It's not a meme, but she went on SNL and a bunch of the like insane rightoid culture war freaks are like, well, look at this. Wokeness is dead now. A beautiful blonde woman with huge tits is on my television once again. So that means that wokeness is dead.
Okay.
And,
you really start okay. seeing, like, the overlap between right-wing Twitter and horny Twitter.
Right.
In this whole thing. It's kind of a circle.
I'm shaking my head. I've got a...
You know, I will say, to bring it down to earth... a little bit. I do kind of feel bad for Sydney Sweeney, just in kind of the way that people talk yeah. about her. Like, the clips that I've seen of, like, interviews with her, like, she seems witty, savvy, down to earth, you know, and she's become this sort of, like, current symbol of culture war that is going to be forgotten about 2 weeks from now, so it doesn't really fucking matter. But
it's like, it can't be fun to be swept up.
Anyway, the point is, this is the first time I actually saw her act in something, and I thought she was okay. I thought she was fine.
She was good.
She is one of the... I did see that she is one of the producers of this movie, and not just an exec producer. Like, apparently she was... quite involved in the process, so this is something of a passion project for her.
This is kind of a star vehicle for her.
Sure.
Think about it. Like, it's an elevated horror-like starring her.
It sure has the veneer of an elevated horror film.
Well, it's produced and distributed
more
by...
on that later.
it's produced and distributed by Neon, right? Yeah. Which are, you know, they're not quite at the level of A24. They're sort of like the less pretentious A24, I guess, at the moment, but they do a lot of the same kind of elevated horror. And this movie very much presented itself as that for the first half, I would say. And then, you know, we'll get into spoilers later, but it becomes something very, very different in the second half. I'd say it becomes pretty much full camp. Which I was very much not expecting.
Because full nunsploitation.
Yeah, you had mentioned when we were leaving the theater, Ben, that this is the most won over by a twist you've been since Malignant.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with that. I don't think this movie quite reaches the heights of Malignant.
No.
It definitely... Thankfully, based on the trailers that we had seen, you know, we were expecting something very Omen-like, you know, a nun becomes, you know, miraculously pregnant with...
Immaculately.
Yeah, I mean, Rosemary's Baby influences all over.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
Like, the spawn of the devil is inside of her. That's the presumption.
Right. It's like, they're acting like she's pregnant with the Son of God, but it's probably going to be the... He's a presumption.
Yeah, fuck you. I'll kill you.
It sounded like presumption to me, and I was like...
Yeah, you yeah, fucking right. Schmurgle motherfucker.
That means, but yeah, run it back. Make phone calls.
What's happening?
I don't know what's happening either. Tease, what were you saying?
I was just gonna say,
Schmurgle motherfucker. What are you? Right, sorry,
you make up words all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fucking rinkus crinkus over here.
Yeah, the rinkus crinkus.
I'm trying to when I do it. Anyway, what are you saying, Tease?
I said presumption.
Anyway, this movie presented itself based on the trailer that a nun gets pregnant with the son of the devil, kind of classic Rosemary's Baby, Omen kind of thing. You know, goes back to what we were saying, that these trailers are playing at the same time as the first Omen, and it's like, oh, they're just showing us the same trailer back to back. Literally, when we went and saw Love Lies Bleeding last week, they did play the trailers back to back. Which
they just run together.
I thought was pretty funny. But, yeah, by the end, the movie is not that. And I think, much to its benefit.
Yeah, it's going to be a challenge to talk about too much more without getting into the spoiler. But I do have a couple of things.
Yeah.
I think just talking about the first half, there are some elements that I think are A24 elevated. Like,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I don't know how else to say it. I frankly kind of hate that whole deal, because like it's so different film to film with A24. And because they're just a,
It's the lingo, though. When you when you say it, people know what you're talking about.
We're Zeitin' with a Geist.
It as shorthand. It's what we have. Yeah, use it as shorthand.
So, anyway, there are elements here that I think are elevated. More than anything else is the sound design. I thought this movie had really, really good sound design.
Mm-hmm.
There's just lots of little textural things in this movie. You know, I've just noticed when the camera pans by candles, like the sound for them is like really brought out, and like all the little candly bits. This movie it's very auditorially tactile, and I liked that. I love how the choir stuff is sort of worked into the ambience as well. It sounds great from beginning to end. Like the movie has great audio, and I think it's like maybe worth seeing in a theater for that, if that's your jam.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's paired with a great score, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought the music was really incredible. It's very ethereal, kind of This Mortal Coil or Cocteau Twins-esque. Mm-hmm.
And very choir-heavy, choral. And they do a lot of it diegetically as well, because it takes place in a convent, you know, in Italy. Yeah, I loved all of this stuff. And I think the movie looks very nice as well.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure it was shot on film. It looks like it was. They could have added that grain digitally, but it looks like film to me.
Mm-hmm.
The location that they're shooting at is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's part set, part actual location. It's very well shot, and it's very well lit, and it's got all these kind of hallmarks that you come to expect of these kind of, you know, A24 elevated horror films.
However, I think that the sequencing and the beats are, for the first half, generic as fuck. Like, there are so many sequences
that we've seen
a million times before. And I love the sound design for all of those sequences. And that's what I really found because I was trying to have a good time. I've got a nice big tall glass of cider while watching the movie. And I'm like, I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be at the movie with my homies. And watch the film and enjoy it. You know, I don't like going to a movie to be cynical. I'm trying to not be that guy. And there was enough for me to not be. However, like, a few times I felt like I was trying a little hard. Like,
I honestly did not think the first half of this movie was that bad. I thought it was a little dry. I don't think the script is like super tight, and I wasn't particularly impressed with any of the acting. But again, great sound, great music, great location. It looks very good. The vibes were all there. There was, you know, there was an undercurrent of, like, sinister tension. And while I wasn't blown away by any of it, I was satisfied, I guess, at least. Yeah, like, I wasn't having a bad time.
Yeah.
I was waiting to be excited.
Ben, you were shuffling around your seat a lot.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, I feel like the cold open, we have Simona Tabasco, who is also in White Lotus.
Oh, okay.
She is trying to escape the convent, and we see things go very wrong for her.
Yeah,
and I thought that sequence was really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we even get a sort of buried alive sort of thing happening.
Yeah,
yeah. I felt like, again, like it's well shot. It's well, like it's pretty well acted. And the practicals are quite good, and the setting is quite good. But, like, man, shit, I've seen a million times. She's creeping into the nun's place to get the keys. She's trying to get out the main gate, and she's shuffling through all of the different keys as the nuns are slowly coming up behind her, Jason style. She squeezes through the gap in the fence instead. They break leg. Leg break looks pretty good.
Yeah.
I thought that was great.
Yeah, they break her leg for sure.
Yeah, because like you think they're just going to grab her leg and pull her back in, but instead they just like rack it against the side and snaps it in half. And then we cut to black, and then we hear the sound of a matchstick, and she's being buried alive. And the scene is it's well acted, it's well shot. But again, I've seen it so many times.
Yeah, it's not particularly original, but I thought it was. I mean, you don't need originality to be effective, and I thought the scene was effective. I thought particularly what I enjoyed is that the audio of that scene continues over the opening credits, and that the credits are kind of like backlit by her match, right?
Yeah, and it's
giving us the opening credits while we're hearing her like screaming and crying and begging for her life. And like, yeah, you know, I thought it was well done.
I thought it was a fairly strong cold open.
Yeah.
Which kind of made the next half an hour feel kind of boring
a little slow.
Because, you know, it's all Sydney Sweeney kind of being introduced to this new convent. You know, she's coming from America. She's trying to learn Italian, not doing that well.
Takes a long time to learn a language.
Yeah, sure, fair. But it's mostly her getting acclimated, and we get bits and pieces, you know.
I will say, and I don't know if this is a totally fair critique, but I'm going to say it anyway. And I think my biggest problem with Sydney Sweeney in this movie is not necessarily her performance. I think she becomes quite a good scream queen in the second half.
Oh, yeah. Strongly agree, yeah.
But when she has stuff to do, she's good.
Right. Yeah. I don't, and again, maybe this is an unfair critique, but I don't really buy her as a nun. I just don't. And it has nothing to do, and it, like, before anybody makes an assumption that's like, oh, she's too hot to be a nun, like, that's not really what I mean. But she has this kind of disinterested Zoomer affect that feels very out of place.
They try to emphasize, like, her meekness.
Right.
And I don't read her performance as particularly meek.
I agree with you.
I do too.
You know, she is definitely kind of disaffected.
Right.
You know, and I think that's one of Sydney Sweeney's, I hate to say it, but weaknesses as an actress. I think she can do the big really well, like the big scenes and the big emotions really well. But the small,
she doesn't pull off subtlety very well.
It doesn't work as well.
I kind of agree with you. Now, what I will say, I agree that this 30-minute chunk of introduction, vibes aside, which I do think the vibes are immaculate, pun intended. there's not a whole lot going on, and I can kind of see where y'all are coming from with not being super interested by it. But I do think there are some highlights. Some good sort of foreshadowing and lore world building. What I like is, you know, she arrives there and she's introduced to all of the people, and we, you know, get introduced to some characters. There's the one sister who's very like severe and seems to like not cold. Like her very cold, you know, doesn't like her very much. And she meets like her friend, the one who seems like really out of place there. And she
smoking a cigarette. They're Italians, so they're always smoking cigarettes in this movie.
She mentions that like the father has a knack for kind of finding broken birds.
Yeah, exactly. You know, drawing in these young women who are damaged. And the convent itself is called Our Lady of Sorrow. And it is a convent
cheerful place to be.
elderly nuns to sort of retire to at the end of their life and be taken care of, you know, through their various illnesses and dementia and so on and so forth. It's basically like a nursing home for elderly nuns in this beautiful convent in the Italian countryside. And, you know, she meets this one of the priests there, the father, who, you know, she learns used to be a scientist before he found his calling to God or whatever. This is one of the parts that I do like, that I do think is cool, is after her first night there, when she takes her vows and is, like, welcomed into the convent, you know, they have a little celebration, and she gets a little tipsy or whatever, and she hears what sounds like someone crying, and she finds her way down to this sort of, like, sub-chapel.
Well, I will say, right before that, I do want to mention she kind of shares her backstory to the father.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And kind of a bit of, you know, drunken, loosened.
Yeah.
Looseness. She tells him that, like, she regularly walked on the ice as a young child. And she fell through the cracks one year.
Yeah, when she was, like, 12. Yeah. And her heart stopped for 7 minutes. And, you know, that was sort of her impetus for devoting her life to God. She feels that, like, God brought her back for a reason. So she feels like she is here for a purpose. And, so she follows these sounds down to this sort of, like, sub-chapel and sees, like, a nun, like, prostrated before this altar. And she's got, like, a red veil over her face. And, you know, this kind of freaks her out, and the Mother Superior shows up and explains, and she goes to the altar and shows that they have a relic, a nail that is, you know, supposedly one of the nails.
A nine-inch nail.
one of the nails that was used to nail Christ to the cross. And that they have that here as their relic, and that at Our Lady of Sorrow Convent, they believe that they worship the suffering of Jesus. And she says, suffering is love. Suffering is love. And that's what they worship here. And I like that scene, not only just because I think it's the set is very cool, and I like the relic, I like the nail, but I like that it kind of sets up that, like, I'm really interested in these sort of, like, sub-cult sects of Christianity that, like, do almost kind of, like, pagan-style sort of worship. That I all thought was really cool. They mentioned, too, early on that the convent is built on top of, like, a catacombs that is the burial site of some saint, Saint Stephen or something like that. I don't know my Catholic saints that well. But, so I'm, like, setting all of this stuff up. Where I was kind of expecting it to go was, I'm like, okay, this is going to be one of those things where they've built their convent on some sort of, like, the resting place of, like, some ancient Lovecraftian god or something that they've been worshiping as, like, Jesus or whatever. Didn't quite go that way, but I do...
Or like a demon, really, is, like, the thought. It's like, oh, yeah, in the burial tomb below is some sort of demonic site, and, yeah, like, it's
something like that.
Again, my thought, though, Rosemary's Baby, you know, sure. A cult puts the spawn of the devil in her.
Yeah, I like the nail. To me, it was pretty clear. You know, it's like, oh, okay, this is a Chekhov's nail. You know, in some capacity, it's
gonna come back.
She's gonna stab the demon with it, is what I was thinking. We saw that place out. I like that. You know, she's handed the nail too, and she gets kind of ill and passes out and drops it.
Yeah, exactly.
She drops the relic. It's cool. Oh, also, I want to note that I think that the red veils are super cool. Because they're not just like a red veil over their face, covering their faces. They're kind of skin tight.
Yeah.
There's like a creepy, like, soft impression of a face beneath, with otherwise an all black outfit, and I think it looks pretty fucking cool.
Yeah,
I thought it looked sick.
And these nuns with the red veils are kind of seen multiple times throughout the film, like lurking at the periphery, you know, sort of hinting that something sinister is lying mm-hmm. underneath.
Well, and sometimes much less subtly, so
sure.
I'll touch on that later.
I must say, right after this scene, I also really like her dream sequence. You know, those can be sort of cop-outs in movies, but I enjoyed the way that that was shot.
Yeah, man. I like the way that it's shot. I don't know, man. This movie's got a lot of, like... Got a lot of jump scares in it that I felt like that were kind of...
This jump scare was in the trailer.
I didn't really remember it.
The jump scare aside, like, I think that...
would have been as cool without the jump scare.
Okay. What comes after is cool, though. Like, they have that, like, strobing red light.
Well, what comes before it is very
cool,
too.
Yeah.
We see her before we realize it's a dream, you know, we see her pass out, whatever, and then it cuts, and we see her go into the confession booth with the cardinal or deacon or whatever, the monsignor of this convent, whatever his position is, and she starts giving her confession, and they do this sort of like a traditional like shot reverse shot, and each time the shot reverses to him, he is farther away from her. Like the confessional booth is expanding, at a certain point he just sort of like gets sucked down into like an endless dark hallway. And I thought that was really cool the way they do that. And then, you know, she's leaning forward and we're sort of like dollying into the darkness, and we know the music cuts out. We know we're in for a jump scare.
Yeah.
And if they hadn't put it in the trailer, you would expect typically the jump scare to come from the darkness before her. Right. But she sits back and hands come through the wall behind her and pull her backwards.
Kool-Aid Man style.
Kool-Aid Man. Oh yeah. Well, and they do pull her into this, like you hinted at, Ben, this...
You didn't know the Kool-Aid Man was full of the blood of Christ, did you?
Oh, I knew. I believed. I had faith. But, like, pulls her back into, like, this room with, like, this strobing red light, and she's on, you know, sort of like a table, and she's surrounded by these nuns with the red veils, and one of them is holding, like, the nail, like, the Christ nail, and they raise it above and stab her in the stomach with it, and then she wakes up.
Symbolism,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Because it's not long after that that it's revealed, you know, she starts getting sick, and then she goes to the doctor, and oh my God, she is miraculously pregnant, though she has never had congress with a man or woman. And so, yeah, I kind of like that. It's like in the dream, you know, there's she's being penetrated by the nail that pierced Christ as well. You know, it's like the insemination.
Yeah, well, it turns out later... the line between dream and reality might be a little grayer than it seems.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say about that.
Absolutely. But yeah, I mean, I thought that's all pretty cool. And then it gets kind of a little dull again for
a
while.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, generic bits that pop up. I will say, with reflection, I don't hate this sequence, but there's one where she's sitting in a room, it's a bunch later, and there's a painting of, you know, I don't know, Christ or Mary or some shit on the wall, some religious shit on the wall, and it's held by, like, chains holding it up, and one of the chains, like, pops paranormally.
Breaks.
Other paranormal stuff. But it breaks, like, so conveniently. Anyway, it swings to the side, and written on the wall behind that is a biblical quote. To, like, Corinthians.
Yeah, well, I think it's loose because in the opening scene we see Simona Tabasco, you know, looking at that and writing that. That was her room.
Yeah, it's her room, yeah. Sydney Sweeney has taken her room.
I see.
And we saw her we saw, like, the tail end of her writing something in the wall and putting the
Yeah, which is why it's kind of loose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
So she finds it, and it says, it has a biblical quote saying something about, like, you think it's the light, but it's really the dark.
The devil comes in the form of a shining angel or something like that.
Yeah. Which to me reaffirmed, okay, it's gonna go the way that all of these always go.
Sure, of course. Like, it's not subtle with its foreshadowing by any means. Another great example of that is right before the scene where we discover she's pregnant, you know, she's in, like, the communal, like, bathhouse with some of the other nuns, and she's talking with her, you know, her friend, and her friend is giving her the backstory, is like, oh yeah, I, you know, before this, I was with a guy, and he hit me, and I had to get away, so I became a nun because, it's a job where, as a woman, you don't have to take your clothes off or something, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, this leads Sydney Sweeney to be like, oh, wait, you're not here because of a higher calling? Like, you don't even believe in God? And the girl is like, oh, no, of course I believe in God. Life sucks so much, there surely must be a man responsible for it, right?
Let's go. I like that actress. I like her snark. And again, like that the whole, like, Italian laissez-faire attitude is very fun. It carries on, you know, she continues to see so much that would lead her to believe that nefarious shit is going on, but doesn't really do a lot about it throughout. And that's one problem I have with this bit leading up is, again, it's carried with the weight of an A24 film, but yet it's, you know, stuff that we've seen a million times before. There's so many sequences that are letting our main character know terrible shit is coming. And she's not really doing a lot to protect herself, like, throughout that.
Of course not. She's too meek. She's too meek to take action. Yeah, the meek shall inherit the earth, and that's her, right? Like, yeah.
So,
that's why she's chosen to bear the new Son of God, is because of her meekness.
Well, that, to me, is culminated to a punchline when she's walking through the courtyard. At this point, like, she's being treated as this, like, holy mother.
As a saint.
You know, as a saint. You know, nuns are walking past her and offering blessings. Everyone stands when she enters.
Well, they have that absolutely gorgeous scene where they basically dress her up.
Best shot in the movie.
Where they basically dress her up like the Virgin Mary.
The color grading, like, it just looks like a fucking fresco. Mad respect.
We've been, gorgeous. You know, dancing around elevated horror. That's the most elevated horror ass
it's a great shot.
It's beautiful, though.
It's like, that is the flower girl sequence in Midsommar.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
That is, yeah, like, to a T.
Yeah, it was great. So she's walking through the courtyard, and the music gets very tense, and she looks up at the window and just sees, like, the fucking Red Skull villains looking down at her through the window. And it's, I laughed. Like, it's just, I thought the designs were so cool. They're so intimidating. But when you just put them out in the daylight, like, glaring down at her, like, it's just so evil, it's funny.
Yeah, dude, because at this point, the movie is starting to descend.
Yeah, we're tipping. That's fair.
We're getting to the tipping point where it's starting to descend into camp.
Yeah.
Like, we're, everything
starting
that,
to get good.
Everything that we're talking about, everything that we've been talking about up to this is, like, the traditional elevated horror ass stuff, you know, which I will even continue to describe. It's all quite dry. This is, you know, we're getting, it's starting to tip.
Well, you can go on about, like, the rest of that scene, because I think that's something we see a lot in the trailer is, like, woman falls or jumps off the balcony.
Yeah.
And,
well, it's the
makeup is real good. Her face all fucked up.
Ooh, yeah.
There's
some really good gore effects in this movie, just in general.
Unexpectedly brutal at times. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's galling.
And this is the kind of the character that we talked about before, like Sister Isabel or whatever, who is, like, very cold and severe and sort of off-putting, and she's just continued to get more so throughout the movie. And like a scene or two prior to this, she tries to drown Sydney Sweeney in the bathhouse. And she's saved the last minute, but the whole time she'd be like, "You bitch, it should have been me. It should have been me. They have to try again with me."
I might have to go to horny jail for this one, but they knew exactly what they were doing, putting Sydney Sweeney in like a white sheer outfit in a bathtub where you can just see her titties just out of her shirt.
That whole scene, like, that scene starts, I'm trying to like be in the movie, I'm in a movie theater, and the person sitting next to me is literally going awooga awooga and like elbowing me the whole time. Oh, yeah, like, real, I can't believe there's the person in the movie.
And he's right to do it.
Ben, you're a fucking degenerate.
Ben kept saying awooga, and he was right to do so.
Yeah, I mean, come on, it's a nunsploitation movie. They're following in the tradition of exploitation and sexploitation movies. Nun exploitation movies are historically very sexual. And so it's not...
You know, historically, you're right. Awooga, awooga!
I mean, you're
right. It's just a...
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, she got those things on her.
Yeah, she...
Shut up! Shut up!
I'm the Norman Rockwell painting of the guy standing up. To me, Ben is right to say it. He's right to say it. My man is being unfairly persecuted. I mean, it's got like, they know what they're doing, right? Like, they know what they're, especially, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but especially considering Sydney Sweeney's reputation and what a lot of the populace knows her for. They know what they're doing. They know what they're doing.
Yes. And I will not be ashamed for it.
And you shouldn't be.
Awooga.
Awooga.
Shaking my head.
Okay, well, I think we've built up to this. There is a twist that we must discuss.
Spoilers ahead. I think we've done a very good job. I say pats on the backs all around. We did a good job discussing the film leading up to this moment that I think we've all been champing at the bit to talk
about.
If
you're even somewhat interested, check out now.
Watch the movie.
Go see the movie and come back.
Yeah.
And what's so fun about this, too, is it's not even a third act twist. It's like a midpoint twist where, you know, Sydney Sweeney is at this point after all of this, she's finally like, okay, something is like for sure fucked up going on here right now.
Before we jump straight into the twist, there's a couple of moments where it starts escalating. Really nicely.
Yeah, oh my God.
You're gonna twist edge me. All right. I guess
this does. I think I know what you're gonna talk about. Because this does happen technically before the twist. You're right.
Yeah. So the first one is Sydney Sweeney, her friend. You know, kind of the outspoken one.
Yeah.
Kind of has enough seeing. You know, they refuse to take Sydney Sweeney to the hospital to check up on her pregnancy.
Yeah.
And they're very strict about, you know, kind of controlling her.
She's looking out for her friend.
She gets fed up, and she calls it out.
She's like, yeah, there's something fucked up going on around here. And they drag her away. And later, like, Sydney Sweeney is, like, out. This is a very sort of, I thought, a nice, like, traditional old gothic horror kind of scene. Candle. Where she's wandering around in a sheer nightdress with a candle. once again, awooga! At this point, I'm just doing it to make Cleveland uncomfortable, really. But, yeah, she's wandering around, and she hears, like, screaming and pleading, and she goes out to, a shed, and she looks through the keyhole and sees, like, the red-veiled nuns with her friend, like, strapped down, and they, like, cut off her tongue.
It's pretty brutal, too.
It is, yeah. And so she is like, okay, yeah, something, like, I gotta get the fuck out of here. And this next scene I thought was as sort of bland as a lot of the rest of the script is, like, I thought this was some really clever writing and editing, the way that this sequence pans out. Yeah, so it starts with, like, the Mother Superior, like, waking up in the morning because she hears, like, somebody screaming, and she's, like, running through, and she gets into Sydney Sweeney's room, and there is blood everywhere. All over the bed, her dress, between her legs, like, something is wrong, oh my god. And they're like, call the doctor, and it's like, oh, it's Saturday, we won't be able to reach him because he's at the hospital delivering babies or whatever. And Sydney Sweeney's like, please, I don't want to die, please, you gotta take me to a hospital. And so they finally, like, they take her and they put her in the car and they're driving her to a hospital. And we cut back to the Mother Superior sort of, like, kneeling at Sydney Sweeney's bed and praying, like, over the bloody blankets. And she's, like, rubbing the bloody blankets on her face.
Yeah, it's fucked up.
And then she, like, bends over and looks under the bed, and there's, like, something bloody, like, wrapped in a pillowcase.
And I agree. I really like how this was for set up at the very beginning of the film. Because when she joins the nunnery, there's a pretty nice montage of her learning her varied duties around the nunnery. There's even, like, a pretty great, like, little moment in that where they're, like, wiping the ass of one of the old nuns. Like, we don't really see it, but, you know, like, they're laid on the opposite side of the camera. And they're like, and if there's anything weird about the feces, like, talk to the doctor. And the doctor, like, turns around in his chair and, like, waves to them, like,
ciao!
Ciao! Oh, yeah, very Italian, of course.
This movie is funnier than I was expecting.
Same.
Like, even in the first half, like, this whole montage of her, like, learning her duties at the convent
sequence.
Is, like, full of, like, good humor. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, part of that, like you were saying, is they're showing them how to kill chickens, like, how to chop their heads off, and, like, Sydney Sweeney can't do it. She's too meek to kill even a chicken. And she's like, oh no, I can't do it. So we jump forward to the scene we're talking about, where, you know, up to this point, it's been presented to us like something is like, legitimately wrong. Like, something bad is happening.
You know, before they refuse to take her to the hospital, but this feels like a desperate enough moment that they disregard that and finally leave in a car to take her to, you know, the local town hospital.
Yeah, and so the Mother Superior finds this bloody lump under the bed wrapped in a pillowcase, and she opens it up, and there's a dead and decapitated chicken inside, and it's like, oh, this is a ruse! Sydney Sweeney...
She found the courage, too.
She found, yes.
It's a good character moment. Like, it's clever.
Yep.
Yeah, she found the courage to kill the chicken
and cover herself in its blood so they'll think that something is really wrong and that they'll take her to the hospital so she can escape. But the Mother Superior discovers it and calls them before she can get to the hospital.
And that was the moment I learned this movie wasn't a period piece.
That was the moment?
Jesus Christ.
Like we're like an hour into the movie, and I was like, oh, it's present day. There's a cell phone going off.
You didn't notice when she got out of the airport and was driving to the convent through Rome that there were all modern cars surrounding her?
No, I wasn't paying attention very much at the very beginning of the movie. I was just kind of thinking about some other
stuff.
I didn't realize
it wasn't a period piece until that moment, but that was about 10 minutes
into the movie. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, throughout the film, like, there's nothing at the nunnery that would make you think it's present day.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, when is this set? Like, I wasn't sure, like, the office with the Italian border guard, what the fuck they called it, the airport, when they're going through their stuff. That whole scene looks like it was from the 60s. The whole film has a veneer of it's very 60s.
Yeah, I'll agree. At that point, I didn't know when it was set either. But then she goes outside and gets in a car, and they're driving through Rome, and they're surrounded
I think at that point, I glanced out.
Fucking Peugeots and Citroens and Maseratis and shit.
But I mean, in fairness, you know, Italian is more ageless than, like, America.
That's just how most of Europe is. And,
it was kind of funny. So, yeah, like, when he gets the call on his phone, it's like, oh, it's present day.
Europe is much older than America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk about a fantastic scene, though. When they're in the car and he gets the phone call.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was probably one of the strongest, you know, in terms of, like, sequences, like, in the movie, to me. Like, her, you know, she's kind of consistently wailing in this quasi-pain.
Yeah, and her sort of, like, slowly, like, she knows that something is wrong, but she's keeping the ruse going, like, because she doesn't know quite yet if he's on to her. And then he, like, finally gives her, like, one look, and she's just like, uh-oh. And it cuts to her, like, sprinting, pregnant, of course, like, at this point, 5 months pregnant, sprinting across, like, a cow pasture.
So this is where, like,
covered in blood.
To me, it went from quality, earnestly tense and scary and clever and well written to hilarious. Like the cut from her, like the look on her face looking back at him being like, "Oh fuck," to her running in the field, to me was cut for comedy. Like I was laughing as she's running through the field. And then like the way it's edited too, where like they're also like just suddenly behind her too, is kind of funny also.
I mean, this is all informing the very necessary shift in tone that is required for the twist. Which we can now finally
and you're right to stop and touch on that.
No, you're correct. You're correct. Thank you. Thank you. Because the twist comes next after they get her back to the convent and through much exposition and classic villain monologuing, our main priest guy reveals that they found on the nail of that pinned Christ to the cross, after closer analysis, they found blood and tissue and bits of bone.
Because before he was a priest, he was a scientist.
That's right.
He was a scientist.
He was a geneticist.
Yeah, they got a Jurassic Park Jesus.
Here. And so, yes, they literally, what they have been trying to do is that they, for 20 years, they have been trying to create,
like the mosquito in Amber,
to create a Jesus clone from the DNA that they're pulling off of this 2,000-year-old nail, and find the right surrogate mother to carry the new son of God.
So much better than a DNA.
It's so funny,
so,
dude.
Oh my God.
It's like, so funny. The part where he's wheeling her through the chapel, and they get to this one room,
fucking,
and there's just like
in jars.
It's like the scene in Alien Resurrection when Ripley goes into the lab and sees all of the other like failed Ripley clones. Like, kill me. It's like he's wheeling her through this like, you know, chapel. He's got these big old like baroque glass jars with like these horribly
freak Christ babies and
distorted mutated fetuses, and he like takes her into the lab,
and then she literally says to them, "So you're trying to play God?" Like right out of Jurassic Park. Who wrote this movie? Michael Crichton?
Shut up. Oh my God.
You know, you were mentioning it feeling like a period piece before, and what I love about that sequence is up until that point, like, the convent is pretty dated. Like, they intentionally make it seem like
primitive, kind of
antiquated. They don't have, you know, any modern technology. And then you know, she's wheeled into the lab and it has all these pieces of modern scientific equipment.
Yeah.
And it's so jarring. That it makes
jarring, literally, because there's babies in jars.
Yes, but
it's
it makes
so
it,
funny, dude.
It's so much more drastic and
Jurassic, even
Jurassic. Yeah,
it's honestly, it is. It's truly the fucking perfect twist because, like, we were, you know, I had mentioned that I was thinking that it's like, oh, this is going to be one of those things where they're worshiping God with Christian, like, iconography, but it's actually, like, an outer God or something,
or
and that has,
demon.
Or a demon or something. You know, like, we're all, like, at this point expecting the supernatural. Up to this point, and I fucking love a mixture of the scientific with the religious. I always will eat that shit up. It's so fucking
it's
fun.
It's so good here, too, because, you know, like, up until that point, honestly, before the movie started escalating, I thought this movie was kind of mid to okay, and then it starts escalating, and I'm like, okay, I'm starting to get interested. And then it hits that twist, and it won me over probably the most since Malignant.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a dramatic twist.
The shot where he's wheeling her through the room with all of the, like, Jesus fetuses in the jar. Jesus fetus. That was, for me, that was a moment where, like, in my head, I was like, oh shit, I'm sorry, Immaculate. I was unfamiliar with your game.
You had like, that dog in you.
Yeah, I did not realize that you had that dog in you like that. And, like, I honestly, during that scene, I just felt myself, like, start smiling so big, and I don't think I stopped smiling until I got into the car after the movie was over.
I gotta say, I know this is an auditory medium, and it's kind of a shame. I wish you guys could, like, just see how happy Tease is right now. Like, he's just
Listen, you know, like, we'll get into the ending and stuff, and, like, there are things that I kind of wish the film did instead of what it did. Like, I don't think that it, like, perfectly executed upon this twist, but it was just so unexpected and so fucking goofy that it just made me, like, giddy, man. Like, outside of my Dune 2 experiences, like, I can't remember the last time something in a movie has made me, like, this giddy, like, while watching it. It's just, I'm like, I cannot believe they're going this route.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
It's so stupid. It's so delightful.
It's
stupid.
So fucking stupid, but, and it's just like, it's like, it sets you up to think that this is a kind of, like, dry, your A24. Typical A24 elevated horror, and it's like, no, actually, this is camp.
Yeah. Guess what? Yeah, you're in the fucking circus.
This
tonight,
is actually exploitation.
It's crazy, yeah. I was thinking about Malignant a lot, too, and I think that Malignant is different in this way, and I think it's better, but I think it's okay that this movie isn't the same. But I think this comparison
Malignant
is
has the gonzo
making.
Action stuff
and Malignant
that, like, really
also,
elevates it.
Unlike this movie, Malignant starts by setting its tone very well. Malignant has a great opening sequence with the Gotham fucking mega insanatorium, like on a hill with the "it's time to cut out the cancer." Like, Malignant lets you know that you're in for a wild ride from the beginning, and I love Malignant for it. I think Malignant is also it uses its crazy budget so well. It's a delight. See your episode on it. It's a charming film. I don't think this movie is anywhere near as great as Malignant. However, I do love that this movie pulls the same kind of bird-brained, fucking wacky-ass shit so late into the film. And, it keeps its card close to its chest. And I think there's something
great about that. But that's the thing, though. It's not that late into the film. It's really not.
It's about halfway in.
It's not. I don't think it's as late into the film as the Gabriel reveal in Malignant is.
Yeah.
It is,
Malignant,
like, halfway.
Malignant is third act.
But also, like, it's so crazy up until that.
Sure.
Point.
I will agree with you. I'll agree with you. Malignant sets the tone better. And this film buries the lead better.
Yeah.
But I was kind of... And, you know, in fairness, I was in the unfortunate position of having the Malignant twist spoiled for me before we saw the film. Talked about that on our episode. But this I saw coming, like, way less. Like,
I had no idea.
I did say earlier how the foreshadowing is kind of ham-fisted in the way that it's, like, letting us know it's, like, there's something going on around here. Like, these people are involved. There is a sinister scheme. They're up to something. But what they're actually up to was so much goofier than what I was expecting that it, like, legitimately blew my
head.
What's
really funny is, like, I was sitting there, like, in the moment, and, like, the guy, the priest said... You know, like, oh, we're using this to fucking clone Christ or whatever. And my gut reaction, my first thought was, are you fucking kidding me? And then I hear Tease to the right of me say, like, are you fucking kidding me? And, like, I was like, you know what?
No, I think I said, oh, fuck yeah.
Oh, fuck yeah. Okay. Yeah, and it's just like, and I was like, okay, I choose joy. Tease is right. Like, so, and it was very fun.
I've always said, like, movies need to go ham like this more often. I think what I'll say about the twist is it feels more like a rug pull than it does in Malignant.
Yes.
It's way more unexpected here, and I feel like it's a bit of a double-edged sword, right? Because on one hand, it makes, like, the drastic nature of the twist all that much more elevated, which is great. You know, it's that oh fuck moment to the point where we really did not expect it at all. On the other hand, even though it's only halfway in rather than full on third act, like, it does make me kind of wish, like, that tone was in the first half.
Sure.
Because, like, I loved the second half of this movie where I thought the first half was just okay.
And I think to play devil's advocate too, like, I could also see how somebody who's, like, really vibing with the tone of the first half of the movie might not enjoy the turn to camp in the second half. Like, I really do. I think we all really do. But somebody who is, like, really digging on the more understated, like, traditional elevated horror shit in the first half might not enjoy the second half.
But I will
half.
Say, like, I think it nails the schlockiness of the second half way more than it nails the, like, the elevated horror.
I agree completely.
Of the first half.
You know, I agree completely.
If you want, like, a slow, religious, you know, elevated horror, watch fucking Saint Maud or something.
Right.
I don't know. Don't watch this movie. Like, you'll get some out of it, but you won't get as much out of it.
Yeah.
And like you brought up earlier, Ben, like, Sidney Sweeney here, like, in the latter half, where it is all screams and camp, I think she does a really good job.
I think she does, too.
I think
she totally wins
way
me
way better
over.
Than she does
good.
Small.
Yeah.
No, I like that.
I absolutely agree.
And I think she does, like, she does big really well. And like I didn't mind the Small so much. I didn't get like the Gen Z vibes necessarily off of that, but I definitely do. I see what you mean. Kind of reflecting
It's not egregious, but no. I don't know. I get it's one of those things where it's like I've been hearing so much about this woman for the last year or so. It's like I haven't actually seen her in anything, and it's like I see it, and it's like okay. But no, I do think you know, to agree with what y'all are saying is, like, she does the big stuff way better.
Yeah, and I will say, like, again, like, that scene where she realizes that they're on to her in the car.
Great.
Is, like, probably the best scene I've seen of her acting in anything I've seen from her so far.
Yeah.
It's legitimately great.
And though I'm you know, generally unimpressed with her more, like, low-key stuff in the first act of this movie, like, all kudos to her in the second half of this film, like, her performance. And also just, like, you know, again, she's a producer of this film, like, she's involved in more of the production than just the acting, and and yeah, especially for, like, as young as she is, like, I think she, you know, overall, like, praise to her.
Praise be.
Yeah.
To she.
They punctuate the exposition scene where they're explaining everything by having a crucifix brand and branding her on both of her feet.
That isn't the same scene, isn't it? God, it all comes so fast.
That's another brutal scene. Like,
yeah.
Again, like, this movie...
Oh, the crucifeet?
Is,
the crucifeet.
...is punctuated by, like, surprisingly intense gore, where you wouldn't expect it, because a lot of the movies of this ilk kind of pull their punches in that regard.
Yeah, I'm glad this one does that.
Definitely does it.
Well, and we get even more of that leading into the climax, because after that, you know, they jump forward in time again a few months to her third trimester, like very close
to... I want to ask you guys about that, because they this is a very nitpicky thing, but they do, like,
the title cards
yeah. of second trimester and third trimester. I don't think they have a first, because the
first
is just the reveal.
Because they give it away. You know? Yeah.
Because they go from her finding out that she's pregnant, they jump straight to the second trimester.
I thought those were kind of superfluous. Like,
I agree.
You kind of assume the jumps in time.
I mean, you can literally see her being her more belly. And more pregnant each time. It's like, yeah, I don't think it's totally necessary.
Just felt a little superfluous.
I agree.
No, I do.
That kind of feels like one of those things that they might not have had in test screenings, and then people being like, I didn't understand the time jumps.
I don't know. It feels like the way, like, it fills the screen, and, like, it's like second trimester, and, like, it's so, like, there's so much build up and impact to it. Like, I think that there's a lot of intent behind it. And I think, again, like, they're going for that A24.
Yeah, man, I don't know. Like that's like kind of the size of the font has nothing to do with when they added it. They
no, can absolutely like you can just framed around it like
that could absolutely
like,
the
pacing, like when it says like second trimester, like we then get some shots of her belly like right after, and like it's all like framed around that. Like,
yeah, and if all of that stuff was there in test screenings and people were like, I don't get it, then why not slap the biggest fucking text you possibly can over the shot so we know that we've got to jump it in time. Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's the case, but
to Cleve's point, like, I think like it is kind of a tropey thing of like elevated horror to
day seven.
Make it feel more quote unquote literary.
Yeah,
have chapters.
Exactly. It's very A24-y.
Well, they did it. I re-listened to our episode on The Black Coat's Daughter not that long ago, and that was something that we were all kind of like, is like, why do they do these like weird title cards that feel kind of out of place? And it's like, yeah, I don't know. Those kinds of things are always like, it's hard to determine like what the intent behind it is and whether it's a response to test screenings or not, because like you got to always remember, especially when we're talking about American audiences, in especially recently, like people who go to see movies fucking stupid.
Well, that I won't disagree with you on.
Fucking stupid. And I'm not saying that excludes myself either, but like people Americans who go to see movies are fucking dumb and need to have things spelled out for them a lot of the time.
Yeah, there's a lot of dumb degenerates going to see this movie.
Awooga! Anyway, the third trimester is where things really fucking come to a head, if you will. Because, like, we basically, I guess, I don't know if it's Christmas, if it's supposed to be Christmas time or what. It would make sense for the birth of the new baby Jesus. But we see, you know, that she's, like, laying in bed, and she's, like, very pregnant now, and, like, outside the window, like, the nuns are having some sort of, you know, like, little ceremony and celebration.
They're singing that song, which, you know.
Well, they don't start singing that, but yes, they do start singing Carol, an Italian version of Carol of the Bells, right as Sidney Sweeney picks up a big heavy crucifix off of her bedside table and caves the Mother Superior's skull
she
in
sure
with
does.
It.
This brutally.
This kicks off one of my favorite parts of the movie, where she decides that enough is enough and she's gonna fucking get out of here or die trying, and she just goes around killing everybody with various like symbols of Christianity. She kills the Mother Superior with the big crucifix while an Italian version of Carol of the Bells plays. Crazy.
She does a CQC, a Catholic quick combat with the
rosary. With the rosary. Yeah,
those break in movies all the time.
She garrots the Monsignor with the rosary, like while he's listening to the choir, and then like as she's trying to like find a way out, we see that she grabs the nail from its reliquary.
Gotta grab that nail.
She grabs the nail and she goes down to the lab and starts, dumping like ethanol all over it.
Yeah, they have like 8 things of ethanol just sitting there for some reason.
Yeah, for science.
To preserve
the fucked up Christ babies.
There's
the
Jesus fetuses. Ethanol.
They're also sitting next to big beakers and flasks of blue and red liquid. Like, it's just like...
Yeah. Science juice, you know.
Science juice. It's like, yeah, in a lab, you'll find something flammable. Whatever, fuck you. Who cares?
Yeah.
Who needs formaldehyde when you have ethanol?
I'm pretty sure formaldehyde is pretty flammable as well. So, whatever. She starts dumping shit. The priest comes in and tries to convince her, like, try to talk her out of it. And she runs out and locks the door.
I will say, during the sequence, her water breaks.
And she says, "God damn it!"
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, and, that's before. I think it's right after she kills the mother superior.
Yeah, yeah, she's on her way.
And
breaks,
so
yeah.
She's having contractions.
Right through this whole thing.
Part of the reason the father can get close to her and to the point where he's a threat, and she runs out of the room.
Right, it's because she starts having a contraction, and he like tries to grab her, and she manages to slip past him and slam the door and lock it. But he can like reach through like the bars, and he's like got her by the hair, and she's able to. She sees like a little bit of ethanol like peeking out from under the door, so she's able to grab the lighter and light it, and so the whole lab behind her catches on fire, and she just like hears him like screaming, like explosions and stuff, and she's like lying on the ground like having her contractions, but then she hears the sound of a fire extinguisher and she's like, oh shit. And then it's like we see the fire in the lab like go out, and then like somebody starts like pounding on the door, and he's able to like bust the door off its hinges, and this leads to her fleeing into the catacombs that are mentioned early on in the movie, and there's a little bit of a cat and mouse chase down there.
Yeah, that sequence was pretty well set up. They didn't catacomb it over.
I will say, you know, as she's hiding, we have that classic thing where, you know, she turns and there's a dead body sitting there.
It's her friend who had her tongue cut
I
out.
I honestly wish, since it was the catacombs, I wish there were way more bodies.
Yeah.
Skeletons.
You know, it's weird to me that it was just that one.
Yeah, a little bit.
It's a bit of a nitpicky thing, but... yeah, you're in the catacombs. Give me skulls. I was kind of expecting
the film to go even bigger at this point, and I was expecting her to find like some like hidden temple like in the catacombs where she'd be confronted by all the nuns with like the red veils and everything, and it's like, oh yes, this is our you know, obscure and esoteric worship of this, of such and such saint or whatever. But no, they played a little bit safer than that, and like she eventually, I will say, I do like the way that the stuff in the catacombs plays with like light and dark
and sound design,
and sound again
really good in that sequence.
Yeah, where she's like hiding from him, with, you know, her light turned off, and like we sort of have an idea of where he is based on like the lantern that he's holding. But anyway, she sees like some actual daylight and sees a way out, and she starts like trying to crawl to it. It's a very, reminds me of The Descent, like being born, kind of. She's crawling down the birth canal towards the light. She's being reborn. But before she can, she gets dragged back in into the catacombs by the priest, who's horribly burned now. And he tries to give her an impromptu C-section. He's got a scalpel. And
I gotta say, the badly burned a villain who comes back for one last stand is one of my favorite horror tropes. I gotta say.
Yeah, I never get tired of that, if I'm being honest. Yeah.
Yeah, it's constantly appearing, and it's good every
It's always
time.
Fun. Yeah, and he tries to give her a C-section, and he pretty much does. He cuts her pretty good, but she manages to
the Christ nail.
Yeah, she stabs him through the neck with the Christ nail.
She's on the ground. He's over top of her. He's trying to pin her down and do this C-section.
He's saying a Hail Mary while he's doing the C-section.
He's kind of lying on top of her practically. So his head is over her head. And she hits him in the neck with the Christ nail and pulls it out of his throat, and he just gushes blood all over her, and it's gratuitous. And the scene keeps going, and we get reaction shots of her. Ah, it's blood is spraying her face.
He falls onto her.
He falls on top of her, and she's covered in blood, trying to get out. And to me, all very Sam Raimi esque. The kind of shot where there's the person over them and they're being vomited on, or there's blood all over them. And our protagonist is just getting soaked. It reminded me a bit of
Ready or Not, with how bloody that finale gets.
Mm-hmm. He gores all over her, and she pulls herself out from underneath all of that, crawls outside
into the light,
of God. And then we decide maybe we are an A24 movie for just a few more seconds, and we have a drawn out. Acting highlight one-er scenes where she
the final shot of the film
is one long one-er.
And it's just a tight shot of her face
covered in blood
and her screaming with the pains of birth as she assumedly just standing just shits this baby out. We don't see it; it's all just her face, but
we do hear it.
Huge kudos to the sound design. It sounds so fucked up.
It is not making the sounds of that a baby would make.
No, it's a weird rasping animal. Yeah. And
and we see the look on her face too as she sees it, and we know that it's something abominable.
I love the attention to detail in that scene. Not only the sound design, but once she has the birth, she grabs the umbilical cord and
tears it with her teeth. Yeah, like an animal.
And it's actually hard for her to tear.
Yeah.
She struggles a little bit getting it. And it just textural elements add so much because we don't see the baby in focus, which is good for the movie, I think.
Yeah.
It's a weird choice for a campy film.
It's ultimately good for the film,
yeah,
I think.
Everything is implication.
With this route that it decides to take. So, as the shot continues, we're still just, focused on her face, and she walks over and picks up, and it pans down, and she picks up a huge rock.
Now, I will say, up until that point, when she bites the umbilical cord, I think I even said out loud, I'm like, they better show the fucking baby. I want to see the mutant. To make the joke again, I want to see the baby. You know, I felt that way right up until she leaves that spot. She starts walking away to pick up a big rock.
And as she's picking up the rock, we see the baby on the ground out of focus behind her. You can't get any sort of detail. But
it's a weird bloody lump.
Yeah, it's a weird, dark bloody lump. It does seem kind of unnatural. Yeah.
And it's very Rosemary's Baby, to spoil Rosemary's Baby.
It's true, you never see the baby. The horror is
her face looking at the bassinet and, what is inside. We don't see
but
we know she sees it, and the horror is that.
Yeah.
And I think this movie does something very similar.
It's doing the same thing, basically. Yeah. And the film ends with she raises the rock above her head, and as she brings it down with a wet crunch onto Jesus 2.0, the film cuts to black and the credits roll. And, For a minute, I was totally... I heard you say they better show the baby. Like, I was totally there with you. For the route the film takes, I think they actually went about it perfectly.
I love that ending.
I do, too. I love that ending as well. There's the part of me that before we got to that final shot, there's the part of me that what I was looking for was her giving birth to a horrifying monster demon baby that she then has to fight.
Yeah.
That's where I was expecting the movie to go, and there's a part of me that's disappointed that they didn't go that far, but for the decision that they made, for the route that they took, I think they handled it excellently.
And two, like, I don't... This movie, like, uses its budget, like, pretty damn well, and I don't think there was any room for a mutant baby monster
probably
fight
not.
So,
probably
like,
not.
Again, full credit, like, I agree, and because I was thinking the same thing throughout the film, but in hindsight, now that we've seen the whole movie, looking back at it, I don't think that was ever a reality for this
probably
film.
Not.
And that's okay.
Probably not. I think that was a reality or a possible reality during the scene where they're giving the exposition and we see all the other babies in the jars. Like, I do very much during that scene, I was like, yeah, we're getting a mutant monster Jesus baby. Let's fucking go. And the movie did at the end, like, I can't say that it toned itself down.
It's
not
cool.
Fair.
She crushes it with a big rock.
Yeah,
She
crushes a Jesus clone baby with a big rock at the end. It's like, I don't really know what else I could ask for.
I feel like you kind of get more out of the implication.
I made the joke like, oh, they're suddenly deciding to be an A24 movie again. But I will say also, too, that kind of brings it all back around.
Because
the film has had that weight to it. It's treated itself like that right up until it isn't. So to kind of bring it back around at the end and do like an impressive one-er with some really incredible acting.
Yeah, she's great in that.
That shot is awesome.
Again,
like she's
so
great
good.
When doing big.
Yeah.
I that is amazing.
A very similar film, or not a similar film, but like an actual A24 movie fairly recently did something I think much better with Pearl. Because Pearl also does that, like, held one-er at the very end of the movie.
Yeah, kind
of. You know, like, where we just get, like, that close, that tight shot of her face with her just acting at the camera. And I prefer Pearl for that, and just in general. But even still, I think it's different enough. I respect it. It's powerful and it's cool. And, yeah, I know. Still respect it, like, a lot. I think it was great.
Do we want to rate this movie?
I think it's time.
Yeah.
Cleve, why don't you add a rating on to what you were saying there? Man, I think that's you're kind of...
I usually don't go first, and I was kind of expecting to hear y'all's verse.
Go with your gut.
This whole time, this whole time I have been kind of torn between a strong 3.5 and a 4. And I think I'm going to go ahead and stick with a strong 3.5. I like this movie. I think it's fun. There are, like, while the sequences are, for the most part, like we've said, tropey, we've seen it many times before, they are largely well executed, and that's more important. I do agree, but even still, they're just things I've seen so many times before, that it's not gonna elevate it as much to me. But the camp is great, but again, I'm reminded of Malignant, which I much more prefer. Just generally, like, I think the issue is this movie is somewhere between an A24 movie and a fucking bonkers Malignant film. And the issue is I think that there's a lot of A24 movies that carry that elevated horror better, and there's camp that I like more as well. So I think a strong 3.5 is good for me.
Yeah, I think as I was leaving the movie and on the drive home, I was in the same kind of position going back between 3.5 and a 4. I think, though, that I'm going to give it a little bit extra, and I'm going to give it a 4. I agree that the first half is kind of dry. It didn't bother me that much. I was still mostly entertained, but, like, I get the critique, but the vibes are excellent. And I think that some of the sort of generic tropiness ultimately serves as a sleight of hand to bury the lead for how fucking goofy the second half of the movie is.
That rug pull.
It's the rug pull. And if it had done more of a Malignant thing and expressed that kind of tone earlier on, I don't think I would have been as surprised by the twist. So for that, I'm going to give it credit. So it's going to get a 4 out of 5 for me.
You know, it's funny. I think the first half of the movie up until, like, the tongue cutting is probably a 2.5 for me.
Oh, wow.
And the second half of the movie, past that, is a 4.5. So I'm going to split the middle and give this a 3.5. It's got the score, it's got the gore, and it's got more, if you know what I mean.
Yeah!
Awooga.
Awooga!
Well, okay.
Yeah, no, it's worth checking out. It's a fun movie.
We don't do this very often, because I think generally on the podcast, we're kind of trying to find, like, some sort of collective quality or collective truth, you know? Like, when we rate stuff, usually during our discussion, we kind of win each other over one way or the other, you know, over the years. I think that's just sort of been our format. But here, like, when I gave it a 3.5, I was really happy to hear, Tease, like, hear you give it, like, a 4. Because, like, I could see, like, how much joy this movie brought you. And I think that's just as valid as, like, any of my critiques.
It really did. I will certainly not deny that this film has problems, and it does. But, I mean, yeah, it just fucking made me smile.
That's
like,
important.
I just, like, it genuinely brought me joy in how fucking stupid and weird it got. And I just respect the shit out of that. But that will give Immaculate an average of 3.7 out of 5. And I say, yeah, hey man, go fucking check it out if you haven't seen it. I don't think it's a theater must see, but it looks and sounds great. So if you got nothing better to do, yeah, go see it in theaters. Why the fuck not, right?
Yeah. Well, because Dune's also showing.
Yeah, but you've had your chance
see both.
Yeah, see both. You've had your chance to see Dune, all right. We've all already seen it twice.
Yeah, I don't.
I'm thinking about a round 3 at some point.
Dude, me too. Let me know when you go, dude.
We did predict this, but we don't we'll cover those next week because we don't have opening weekend results yet. But next week, we're doing another new movie. What is it, Ben? What's next week?
Godzilla X Kong.
Oh, it's Godzilla X Kong time. Whoop-dee-doo, I guess.
The boys are back in town.
I'm a little hopeful.
Man.
Because the previous one kind of won me over by how stupid
it
was by the
honestly,
end.
This one,
it looks like they're leaning into the stupid. Maybe it's Drek. It's probably Drek. But
Godzilla Minus One is too fresh
for
me.
Exactly. I'm feeling a little down.
Don't expect, like, quality. Expect dumb. Like, expect dumb fun. Like,
yeah.
That's what I'm going to try to do.
Because I agree. Like, Godzilla Minus One was one of the best things I saw in 2023. And, like, if I go into this movie expecting that, no, that's stupid. Like, no,
I'm not going in expecting that, but the aura of that is still close to me.
Yeah, they're almost different. Like, I know that they both have Godzilla in them, but they're almost different genres.
It's going to be difficult to separate.
Like,
but anyway,
different
whatever. Next week is Godzilla X Kong, Big Monkey, Big Lizard, Part 2. They're back. Now there's a nasty monkey that they have to fight.
he's a gauntlet.
Yeah, why don't we do a sponsor, Clay?
And there's a baby Kong, which I think is pretty dumb. They're like, oh, baby.
Yeah, he looks
baby,
like shit.
Baby
the baby Kong looks like shit.
But in fairness, there's baby Kong is much older than.
We'll talk about baby, it next week. What's our sponsor?
Our sponsor this week is very fitting. This week is brought to you by the Lisan Al Gaib.
Oh,
go see Dune 2 in theaters.
Go see Dune 2.
Fucking awesome.
Lisan Al Gaib, thank you. Voice from the outer world, the Kwisatz Haderach, Paul Muad'Dib Atreides. Thank you for sponsoring this episode of the podcast.
Hey, Tease, where is, I'm trying to remember, where is the, what is the Harkonnen homeworld called?
Gaiety Prime?
That's right, okay. Like, what was the joke? Anyway, yeah, get it, Gaiety Prime, thank you.
Gaiety Prime.
How's it going?
Well, that'll bring us to the end of this week's episode. If you like the show, don't forget to rate and review us. That helps us get into more people's podcast algorithms.
Tease, where is the Colosseum fight in Dune 2? Where is that location called?
Gaiety Prime.
No, never mind.
What are you looking for?
The Salaeus Secundus. or whatever.
Seleucus Secundus is the Sardaukar homeworld,
oh,
which
Sardaukar
we do
homeworld.
Not,
oh,
which we do not see in Dune Part Two. We only see that in Dune Part One.
Fuck.
Well, you're a
actually,
fake fan.
I'm a fake,
you're
well,
a fake
actually,
fan.
Okay, no, sorry, the rest.
Sarcandus. Sarcundus.
All right, kind of. No, my joke was going to be Secundus nuts. It was going to be the joke, but
well,
you, know,
you got us there eventually.
I got us
there,
yeah, but fake fan.
You fucked it up.
Fake fan.
You fucked it
I
up.
Can't remember names.
You could have got him, but you did not got him.
I didn't. All right, wrap it up.
Nobody got me. All right.
Let's get away from this.
Yeah, you can, of course, also support us at patreon.com/podpeoplepod. Shout out to our honorary pod boys, Sam, Zach, Mike, and Mitchell. Y'all are the best. Thank you.
The best.
You can follow us at letterboxd.com/podpeoplepod as well, where you'll find a list of all the films we've talked about on the show with our average ratings, links to those reviews. For my recommendation this week, I'm going to do a kind of unorthodox one. I'm mostly loath to recommend like true crime stuff. I think that it's got a weird grip on our culture right now and people are too into it. But Werner Herzog, surprise, surprise, as sort of a spiritual sequel to his 2010 documentary Into the Abyss, he did a 8-part series called On Death Row, where he interviews death row inmates, mostly in Texas, but I think he also talks to a couple guys in Florida. And it's got some kind of Dateline-y style framing that I feel like they put on after the fact, but Herzog is just one of the best interviewers there is, and the way that he, like, approaches each of the stories, neither trying to prove or disprove, but just offer multiple perspectives and, first and foremost, show that the people who are on death row are people and humans while not doing apologia for the crimes they've committed. It's just, it's heavy, but it's very good. I watched the whole series over the course of like 3 days. It's all on Tubi. It's called On Death Row. Would recommend.
Yeah, I think I've seen it. From what I
it's
remember,
good.
It's
yeah.
very good. At least I've seen Into the Abyss. I feel like I've seen an episode or two. But yeah, talk about heavy, heavy
yes.
shit.
Yes, bleak.
You guys are going to laugh at me for this one. My recommendation, I wanted to pick something nun-themed, so I'm going to recommend Sister Act 2, Back in the Habit.
For real?
Yeah. Directed okay. by one of the great African-American actor-director, Bill Duke. Bill Duke directed this
Did
film.
He really?
Yeah. Duke? Yeah.
Directed yeah. Sister Act 2, Back in
Absolutely,
the Habit? Okay,
yeah.
I did not actually know that.
You know, I think it's much better than the first Sister Act movie, personally. And I think it's a fun, enjoyable, comfort movie. It's one of my mom's favorite movies, so I watched it a lot growing
awesome.
Up.
Awesome.
Okay.
And yeah, I think it's really enjoyable.
I've been watching Shogun.
Hell yeah.
Lately, I'm drawing my blade.
I've heard it's great. I'm very
yeah.
excited to check it out.
Yeah, so,
I'm a little
so
behind,
far so but... awesome. Yeah, I've been having a delightful time with it. The main character, John Blackthorne, makes some absolutely just head ass decisions throughout the show that I find to be very funny and enjoyable. It's just, you know, the shogunate Japan stuff is extremely cool, and
keeping the spirit of Glorious Nippon alive.
Yeah, absolutely, and I really appreciate that, like, they the main character, even though, like, you know, it's set in Japan, like, it's kind of, you know, like we're pushing up on the white savory stuff. I think its largest saving grace is that Blackthorne is a staunch Protestant Englishman, and from a modern lens, that is about as alien as to us as any of like the culturally Japanese stuff. And it makes the whole thing like it's so fish out of water, like, on both sides, that I find it to be really enjoyable.
Would you call it an isekai?
I would. Okay. I really would. but I would recommend it though. Like I think it's got some really wacky shit. So far.
All right.
I'm enjoying it.
I'm looking forward to checking it out.
If you liked, like, Netflix's Marco Polo, you'll fucking love it.
Never watched that.
Me either.
But anyway, thank you for listening. Until next time, pray for us now and at the hour of our deaths. Amen.